Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, researchers report that more than 40% of honeybee hives died in the past year, the second highest loss rate recorded. The AP story lists mites, poor nutrition, and pesticides in that order as possible causes for what's been called an almost biblical bee decline, but pesticide makers would have you think they don't belong on the list at all. Are there PR efforts affecting even government research? We'll hear from Tiffany Fink Haynes of Friends of the Earth. Also on the show, the vivid and powerful New York Times series on conditions for workers in nail salons was the definition of impact journalism. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announced responsive measures just days after the stories ran. But are occasional blockbuster stories the best media can do for workers' rights issues? What's the next step? We'll talk about that with journalist Michelle Chen. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press. When conservatives win elections, you can expect some in the U.S. press to say the lesson for U.S. liberals is they must move to the right. That's true even when the elections are in other countries. Thus, USA Today's Michael Wolff made use of last week's balloting for the British Parliament, in which the Conservative Party won around 37% of the vote but took half the seats in the House of Commons. The result, wrote Wolff May 10th, overturned, quote, many popular media notions of what a restless electorate is against – bankers, corporate power, tax dodgers, economic austerity – and what it is for, fundamental change, leveling the powerful, taxing the rich, and big social program promises, close quote. This leftward shift, we're told, might be driving Hillary Clinton's campaign, so it's notable that British voters rejected the Labour Party's, quote, picture of a floundering nation that needed to be overhauled and rescued by new spending plans paid for by new tax-the-rich schemes, close quote. Except that's not the picture that the Labour Party painted at all. Far from making big social program promises, what Labour actually promised was to balance the budget, to cut the deficit every year, and to maintain a competitive corporate tax rate. Standard bearer Ed Miliband personally pledged to cap Social Security spending and child benefit increases. In short, Labour promised austerity, not all that different from conservatives. This was noted by, for example, New York Times columnist Paul Krugman, though that paper's news pages took the line of USA Today's Wolff, blaming Labour's defeat on its opposition to austerity. A May 9th piece claimed Miliband thought voters would favor, quote, an egalitarian party that called for higher taxes on the rich, tighter regulation of business, and increased social spending, close quote. Well, it's possible that Britain might have favored such a party. It certainly didn't favor the deficit-busting platform that Labour actually ran on. Well, The Times' David Brooks also took the opportunity of the UK election to celebrate the wisdom of the centre-right. But as economist Dean Baker noted, the columnist relied on a caricature of the left to make his case. Over the past few years, Brooks lectured readers, quote, left-of-center economic policy has moved from opportunity progressivism to redistributionist progressivism. Opportunity progressivism is associated with Bill Clinton and Tony Blair in the 1990s and Mayor Rahm Emanuel of Chicago today. This tendency actively uses government power to give people access to markets through support for community colleges, infrastructure, and training programs and the like. But it doesn't interfere that much in the market and hesitates before raising taxes. This tendency has been politically successful. Clinton and Blair had long terms, close quote. By contrast, Brooks writes, quote, redistributionist progressivism more aggressively raises taxes to shift money down the income scale, opposes trade treaties, and meddles more in the marketplace. This tendency has won elections in Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren, and New York City, Bill de Blasio, but not in many other places, close quote. Neoliberal chin strokers like Brooks have a usefully elliptical understanding of market economics when it comes to their favored politicians. Bill Clinton, for instance, Dean Baker points out, promoted trade agreements that put manufacturing workers in competition with low-paid workers in the developing world while maintaining or increasing protections for highly paid professionals like doctors and lawyers. The resulting upward redistribution of income wasn't due to market forces, but to policy design. Clinton beefed up copyright and patent monopolies, including on drugs, a government intervention in the market that, among other things, amounts to a tariff of several thousand percent. When the Federal Reserve Board raises interest rates to slow job creation, stifling wage workers' ability to gain bargaining power, that's government intervention, too. The fact is, pundits like David Brooks don't disapprove of meddling with markets, as long as that meddling favors the wealthy and the corporate. And finally, it's common for journalists to lament the public's taste for the sensational, when they themselves would prefer to report seriously on serious matters. Except then there are some ostensibly serious matters that they treat as a veritable cartoon. One such example is North Korea, an official enemy for whom regular journalistic rules don't seem to apply, making it unsurprising to see the May 12th Washington Post story, pointed out by the blog Left Eye on the News, saying that North Korean General Hyun Young-chol, a high-level official, had been executed by anti-aircraft gun for insubordination and treason, including for sleeping during a meeting in which Kim Jong-un was speaking. Says the Post, quote, "The report, if true, would starkly illustrate the brutal extent to which the young North Korean leader is going to consolidate power," close quote. Well, you'd only report something you don't know to be true if the source is solid, right? Most of the information in the article is based on what, quote, "officials from the South Korean National Intelligence Service told local reporters at a briefing in Seoul," close quote. As for what the Post heard directly, quote, "an NIS spokesman confirmed to the Post that it believed Hyun had been executed," close quote. Okay, so South Korean intelligence is the reliable source. Except that the article's eighth paragraph says, quote, "the NIS report could not be independently verified. NIS's claims turn out to be wrong as often as they are right," close quote. Well, naturally, the general may indeed have been executed. The takeaway is that the Washington Post doesn't seem to care much whether he really was or wasn't. On some stories, speculation is good enough. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Listeners will have heard about massive bee declines in recent years that have alarmed scientists and others aware of the vital role bees and other pollinators play in our food and farm system. The White House has a task force on pollinator health that's expected to announce a plan soon for bee protection. That task force is co-chaired by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. But a group of folks, including beekeepers, farm workers, and food safety organizations, sent a letter to the USDA Inspector General last week. They're concerned by reports that the work of the department's scientists is being censored and suppressed, particularly research into insecticides known as neonicotinoids that are a primary force behind bee declines. What can the task force's protections amount to, the signatories wonder, if the USDA's own research is compromised? Tiffany Fink-Haines is Food Futures campaigner at Friends of the Earth. She joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Tiffany Fink-Haines.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, the May 5th letter came in the wake of the legal petition filed by the group Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, calling on the USDA to adopt policies to prevent political suppression or alteration of studies. They charge that some scientists working for the federal government are finding their research restricted or censored. But it's not just any research. It seems to be about work that suggests certain conclusions about certain things. What is the particular worry, the particular conflict that Peer and Friends of the Earth and others are talking about here?
The research that the scientists cite as being censored is research into neonicotinoid pesticides, which are a leading driver of bee declines, as you said, and research related to glyphosate, which has been identified as one of the leading drivers of monarch decline. So we're really concerned that as the co-chair of the task force that President Obama created last June, that if this task force, co-chaired by USDA, is censoring its own scientists, how can we expect them to truly develop a plan that will protect bees and not just the pesticide industry?
Well, when you say censoring, towards what end? What does it seem as though the work is being massaged, if you will, to say?
There's been several reports. One senior scientist, for example, from USDA said he experienced a significant amount of harassment and censorship. He said his words are changed. Sometimes his papers are censored or edited. In some cases, not allowed to submit them at all if they run counter to the pesticide industry.
Oh, I see. So it's being critical of the use of pesticides or particular pesticides that seems to be causing the problem.
Exactly, if they question the health and safety of these chemicals.
Now, we're talking about chemicals, these neonicotinoids, that have been researched and, in fact, banned in Europe. Is that not right? And the White House has banned them from federal land, so it's not as though they're free from controversy.
No, there's definitely a growing body of scientific evidence that identifies this class of pesticides as a leading driver of bee decline. As you said, the European Union placed a temporary ban on three of the most widely used neonicotinoids. In the U.S., there's been more than 20 retailers, including the two largest home improvement retailers in the world, Lowe's and Home Depot, that have taken steps to eliminate these pesticides from their stores. And there's been over 20 entities, ranging from states, cities, federal agencies like the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, that have all also taken steps to eliminate and, in some cases, ban them outright entirely from their lands. So it's something that a number of different stakeholders are recognizing as a problem, and it's one step they can take to help to protect bees and create truly safe havens for them.
Well, and I was just reading that the EPA has done a kind of cost-benefit, and the latest research from the EPA seems to suggest that this particular class of pesticides are not even especially effective or beneficial for the uses that they're intended for in terms of protecting plants.
That's right. So in October, they came out with a report that stated that as a seed treatment on soybean seeds, oftentimes neonicotinoids are used as a coating on seeds, and that is the case for all of our big monoculture crops like soybeans, corn, canola, and they're used as a coating on over 140 different crops. And so EPA found that there's really little to no economic benefit to U.S. soybean production when they're used as this seed coating. And then just in April, at the beginning of the month, they put a moratorium on all new uses or products for neonicotinoids. However, it's one small step in the right direction, but that doesn't take into account all of the current uses. There's more than 500 products for 100 uses of neonicotinoids on the market today. So, you know, if they really wanted to address the bee crisis, we'd want them to extend that moratorium to all current uses of neonicotinoids.
The AP report on the latest survey that showed 40% of honeybee hives died last year, the story lists mites, poor nutrition, and pesticides in that order as causes for bee decline, and it followed that up with an assertion from a beekeeper at Bayer, a company that makes pesticides, saying that the fall off in the last year is not unusual at all. Tremendous PR work on the part of the pesticide industry, is there not? I mean, it's a formidable obstacle in terms of reform in this area.
Yes, the report that came out yesterday from USDA is extremely significant. They found that beekeepers are reporting losing 42% of all of their colonies from last year, and that is the second highest annual loss recorded to date. So we're really in a dire situation where we're losing an alarming amount of bees. And the pesticide industry is profiting off of manufacturing these pesticides, and they're willing to do absolutely anything in their power to ensure that they remain on the market. Last year, Friends of the Earth released a report called Follow the Honey, which documents the seven ways pesticide companies are using tobacco-style tactics right out of the tobacco industry playbook to spin the bee crisis to delay any sort of regulatory action on these pesticides.
Well, what are some of those methods?
One is spinning the science and manufacturing doubt about the role of pesticides. So they've gone through an aggressive effort to promote the varroa mite and other factors as the leading cause of bee death, and then downplaying and absolutely dismissing the role of pesticides. What they don't say is that these pesticides are a key compounding factor that makes the bees more vulnerable to pests and pathogens. Another tactic is a lot of PR around this. So, for example, they went on a bee care tour last year where they stopped at key universities, agricultural universities around the country to downplay the role of these pesticides. They often buy credibility, so they've been funding scientific studies, cultivating alliances and strategic partnerships with farmers, beekeepers, and agricultural organizations to really buy credibility for that there's anything but pesticides that are causing the bee crisis. And they'll also blame the user. So in most cases, they'll blame farmers and say that they've applied them incorrectly or that beekeepers are to blame because they don't know how to take care of their bees. One last thing is that they are often targeting children. So for example, Bayer published a children's book entitled Toby and the Bees, where a friendly beekeeper tells young Toby that bees are getting sick, but he shouldn't worry because it's just a problem with mites and there's a special medicine, of course, manufactured by Bayer, that will make the bees healthy.
Well, and it works as far as media go in the sense that virtually any article you read about the role of pesticides in bee colony collapse will include at least a comment or a quote from a pesticide manufacturer, even if it is surrounded by other scientific claims that seem to go against it. The Washington Post last year, for example, in the midst of a lot of data about the role of neonicotinoids, throws in a line that says, others discern fewer clear-cut answers to bee collapse and think the science is far from settled. And then here is a gentleman from Bayer saying, quote, even though all the evidence points to various parasites and diseases being the true cause of poor bee health, we are keen to do everything in our power to give consumers confidence in our products, close quote. I'm not sure if that came from a human or a machine. But, you know, journalists seem to feel obliged to get something like that into every story, but it really doesn't represent the consensus on this.
It doesn't represent the consensus, and it's really unfortunate because if they were willing to not spend these millions of dollars to defend their products, and really they could just support a rapid transition to sustainable organic farming that would support the health of bees and all of us.
Well, and just finally, the good news is that activism around this issue does seem to have an impact. I mean, we certainly didn't know much about bee declines a few years ago. It seems as though environmental groups and others have really mobilized on this issue.
I think that there are a lot of people that really see the bee crisis as something they want to get engaged in because they want to be able to protect the bees, to protect our food supply. And thanks to activists and consumers and people across the country, there's been over 4 million Americans that have signed petitions urging the Obama administration to immediately restrict this class of pesticides. And we've seen that the Obama administration is starting to take action. And there's been over 1 million consumers that have signed petitions urging Lowe's and Home Depot to take action, and thanks to all of their work, they have made public commitments to move away from these pesticides and transition to least toxic alternatives.
We've been speaking with Tiffany Fink-Haines of Friends of the Earth. You can find their work on bees and other issues online at foe.org. Tiffany Fink-Haines, thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me.
A A New York Times series by Sarah Maslin Neer exposed abusive conditions for the thousands of women working in New York nail salons, from low and no wages to harmful health impacts to rampant racism. The series was heavily promoted by the paper and prompted New York Governor Andrew Cuomo to announce a new multi-agency task force for investigations, new rules about dangerous chemicals, and a six-language education campaign to inform workers of their rights. While professing herself gratified at the attention, Times ombud Margaret Sullivan said she wished the paper had exerted similar promotional effort for, quote, investigations on even more weighty subjects, close quote, like one on conditions on Rikers Island. It entails no disrespect to other work to question Sullivan's invidiousness. Surely part of the reason that marginalized workers like those Neer describes can be exploited and overlooked is because elite media gatekeepers deem their plight insufficiently weighty. Not to mention that New York Times readers have a greater likelihood of visiting a nail salon than they do Rikers Island by several orders of magnitude. But that's not to say that the series and the reaction don't raise some questions about how wage workers are presented in the corporate press, who speaks for them, and what is considered sufficient response to exposures of epidemic abuse. Michelle Chen is contributing editor at In These Times, associate editor at Culture Strike. She blogs at The Nation, as well as co-producing Dissent Magazine's Belabored podcast and WBAI's Asia Pacific Forum. Welcome to Counterspin, Michelle Chen.
Hello.
Well, the Times stories, The Price of Nice Nails and Perfect Nails Poisoned Workers, contain the kind of details that stay with you. There's the woman whose fingerprints are disappearing, the workers who recognize one another on the street because of the discoloration in their cheeks that comes from a certain chemical. I wonder, as a reporter, and particularly one with a focus on workers and on immigrants, what were your reactions to this Time series?
The first thing that struck me was actually, wow, I'm glad the Times finally picked up on this, but these issues have been ongoing in the nail salon industry for some years now, and I thought it was great that they gave a shout out to the California Healthy Nail Salon Collaborative, because that's a project that's been around for several years, and they've been working in the Vietnamese immigrant community, largely in the Bay Area, and it's a coalition of workers, community groups, and public health advocates who are trying to work together to find solutions for this industry, and New York is no different than what California nail salons were like several years ago.
That's, in a way, what I want to get to, is kind of who's missing from the Times story. You wouldn't get the feeling that there was any organized resistance. The impression was that workers themselves don't even know about the problems in the industry.
Yeah, or that they just sort of resign themselves to it, right? Or they might get dissatisfied with one boss or finally reach a breaking point and try to find another low-wage job, which sadly is a reality for many workers. But there are community groups right here in New York who are doing good work in terms of educating workers, doing things like Know Your Rights trainings, and trying to tackle some of the systemic issues that make workers vulnerable. It's really not just about chemical safety, though occupational health and safety is a huge aspect of it. It's really also about empowering workers. In a piece that I wrote for The Nation, I was just highlighting an initiative that has just been launched by a group called Adhikar, which works in the Nepali American community in Queens. And they have been working with a lot of nail salon workers, trying to address some of the basic economic justice issues, such as wage theft and, you know, non-payment of wages and excessive working hours, as well as some of the public health issues involved. And they actually just put out a media campaign that tries to educate both workers and consumers about the risks involved.
If the value of a big story like the one in the Times is that it sparks ongoing reporting, maybe we can see some of those people and those groups appearing in the coverage.
Yeah, hopefully. And I hope that regulators, you know, city and state officials take notice of those groups as well, because they're the groups that really have to be engaged. They're often some of the best and the only liaisons between government regulators and the workers, and I guess in turn their employers, and they have roots in the community. And I think that's really important. You know, it's not just about the relationship between the boss and the worker or the consumer and the laborer. It's also about how all these pieces fit together, because many of the problems that these workers face have to do with the way their communities are structured and the way that they interact with authorities. Many of these women were undocumented, and they are structurally marginalized from the broader mainstream economy, and we need to sort of look at how all these issues overlap and intersect with each other.
Well, speaking of that, the Times ombud, Margaret Sullivan, says she wonders why the paper didn't give this kind of big, splashy attention to, say, climate change or poverty or government surveillance. And I thought it was, I know, maybe a minor note, but to distinguish this story from a story about poverty seems to point up a problem with compartmentalization.
Right, given that it is a story about poverty.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, the idea that talking about workers is different than talking about the poor. It's almost as though it works against our seeing those connections.
Yeah, I think to the author's credit, there were two components to this, and they sort of balance the public and consumer health aspect with the workplace justice and the economic inequality issues. I think certainly by focusing maybe on some of the community's response and a follow-up would help in terms of just helping contextualize this. I think some of maybe the initial pushback to this story was that it's a gendered topic,
yep.
Right? And the idea here is that, well, this is about women feeling guilty. They might have their middle class guilt kind of stirred up by a piece like this, but then they might forget about it the next week and go back and get their mani-pedis, right? So I think that kind of underestimates maybe the intelligence of the reader. And I hope that women who read this do care. This is an equality issue that does affect everyone. And to the extent that this is a consumer concern as well as a worker's concern, that's part of what the city regulatory effort is trying to do now. Another piece of what they're looking at is whether or not these places are safe for the general public. And for that matter, there needs to be a lot more reporting on the entire production chain. And that definitely is an issue about environmental justice on a global scale. Our regulatory system is highly dysfunctional when you get up to the federal level, and that is one of the reasons why so many chemical risks are lurking at your corner beauty salon.
We've been speaking with journalist Michelle Chen. Her article, How Can You Get an Ethical Manicure? Support Worker Organizing, can be found at thenation.com. Thank you very much, Michelle Chen, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.